in 1 Samuel chapter 14, which is where we're going to pick up with our series of kingly lessons. We've seen for the last couple of chapters that we have been tracking just about one battle. And it's been a very short span of time. We're going to take a look at a timeline here in just a minute. But 1 Samuel chapter 14, verses 47 and following. When Saul had taken the kingship over Israel, he fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab, against the Ammonites, against Edom, and against the kings of Zobah, and against the Philistines. Wherever he turned, he routed them. And he did valiantly and struck the Amalekites and delivered Israel out of the hand of those who plundered them. Now the sons of Saul were Jonathan, Ishvi, Malchishua, and the names of his two daughters were these. The name of the firstborn was Merab, the name of the younger, Michal. And the name of Saul's wife was Ahinoam, the daughter of Ahimaaz, and the name of the commander of his army was Abner, the son of Ner, Saul's uncle. Kish was the father of Saul, and Ner, the father of Abner, was the son of Abiel. There was hard fighting against the Philistines all the days of Saul. And when Saul saw any strong man or any valiant man, he attached him to himself. Father, as we come to your word this evening, I pray you'd give us understanding in it, Lord, and challenge us with it. We never want to come to your word without walking away changed. And so even as we look at this evening and the historical things, I pray that we would see your mighty hand working in history, working in the lives of these people, and that we would follow you and be obedient to the commands you give us because of it. We pray it in Jesus' name. Amen. This is going to be a summary of Saul's entire career as king. What we're reading right here takes place for the most part after what we've just read, and it fills in an intervening span of time, because when we get to chapter 15, there's going to be a major event in Saul's career as the king. And if you're familiar with your Old Testament history, you'll know that chapter 15 is when God commands Saul to go destroy the Amalekites. And Saul doesn't completely do it. That is going to be pivotal in Saul's reign as the king. Just a few chapters ago, we read when Saul went down to Gilgal and he was supposed to wait for Samuel for 7 days and allow Samuel to offer the sacrifice. But because Saul saw the Philistine army camped at Michmash and he saw all of his troops fleeing from him, he decided to go ahead and offer the sacrifices anyway. Well, that was a mistake. That wasn't what God had told him to do. And the response from God because of that event was, "Your dynasty will not continue in Israel." Okay, so Saul, very shortly after the beginning of his reign, we're only within a couple of years when he was crowned king at first, God tells him, "Your dynasty's not going to last." Now, that doesn't mean that Saul is immediately going to cease being king or that God has rejected Saul himself. But the consequences of that first disobedience were that his kingdom, his family, would not be established as the monarchy in Israel. Chapter 15 is going to take an even worse turn, where God is going to reject Saul himself because of a second disobedience. But in the intervening time, let's go to this timeline here. And I'm going to see if I can turn on a laser pointer. Won't this be fun? Okay, there it is, right? Okay, so how visible is the text up there? Is it visible at all? Okay. All right. Right, the tiny print, don't worry about. Those are notes, what the guy who made this has in there. And even in his book, it's really tiny print. What we want to focus on are the times. So right up here, you can see this is 1101 BC. Up here at the top in a little bigger print, it says 1100 BC. This is going to help us just get an idea of what's going on in history up to then. So we're going to review a little bit. Right down here, can you read that date? It says 1121 BC. This was the period when Eli died, when his sons died. And when the Ark of the Covenant was captured by the Philistines and went into the Philistine territory for 7 months. Okay, if you remember that we covered those things in weeks past. That was right here in the timeline. Okay, Saul was alive at that point, but he wasn't king. He really wasn't on the scene. For the next 20 years, which goes from this point all the way up to here, Israel was lamenting and sorrowing because God had allowed them to be defeated by the Philistines. If you can see right up here, it says the days of Philistines' 40 years of dominion. The book of Judges mentions that for 40 years the Philistines had an absolute dominion over Israel. One of the results of that was what we read in chapter 14, that there were no weapons found in Israel. The Philistines wouldn't allow them to have it because for this 40 years, the Philistines were in control of Israel. All right, so here the ark is captured, and for 20 years, Israel is just sort of lamenting their situation and not really doing anything. During that time, there is in Israel, we don't read about him in Samuel, but we read about him in the book of Judges, another man working down here. You see his name? Samson. Okay? Samson begins his fight against the Philistines right about the same time that the Ark of the Covenant is captured in the battle at Aphek. And so that's the time when Samson is, he goes down to get married, and his father-in-law basically gives his wife to somebody else. And so Samson captures 300 foxes. Was it 300 foxes? Captures a whole bunch of foxes, ties their tails together with torches in between them, and lets them loose into the standing grain. And it was a massive economic catastrophe for Philistia to have that much grain destroyed. He kills 1,000 men with the jawbone of a donkey. He, at one point, rips the gates off of the city and carries them 14 miles and drops them at the base of the walls of an Israelite city. So it's during this time that Samson is active. During this same time period, Samuel is preaching to the nation and telling them, if you want to get out of this situation, there's a surefire way to do it. And what is that? How did Israel, what was the key way they were supposed to go from being oppressed to being victorious? Return to the Lord. And he tells them, how long are you going to go between two decisions? Stop being all upset about your situation and return to God. And so at this point, right around in here, this is where Israel burns all of their idols, they destroy all their idols, and they start to serve the Lord wholly again. And that is when the Philistines gather together, and Samuel leads the army of Israel in a battle that breaks the Philistine dominion. It doesn't break the Philistines' oppression over Israel, but it breaks their absolute dominion. So, from 1101, Samuel becomes a judge. And for the next 6 years or so, he's a judge. By this point, he's already a middle-aged man. His sons are raised. He's been in Israel for a very long time. He's very well known. He was born, I don't have it on here, but he was born way back here, okay? His mother Hannah gave birth to him, and he served in the temple. And then for this 20-year period, Samuel was on sort of a circuit throughout Israel where he would travel around and he would preach to the people. And the major work that was going on during those 20 years was to try to turn the hearts of Israel back to Jehovah because they had been worshiping other gods. Israel had sort of the same problem that mankind has always had. And that's one of the great reasons to study the history of the Old Testament people of Israel is because they are a reflection of us. When Israel got in trouble, when they were sold into their hands of their enemies, their first thought was, my enemies must be stronger than me because their gods are stronger than my gods, so I'm going to go ahead and worship their gods. And maybe that'll bring some relief. And so they would go off and they would serve other gods. And then God would turn them over to their enemies more because they were being disobedient. And eventually they'd come around in this cycle and they would return to worshiping Jehovah. But they provide us with great lessons about our faith and our obedience and how it needs to be consistent. So, right here, Israel returns to the Lord pretty wholeheartedly. And for the next 6 years, Samuel is leading the nation as a judge. But then in 1095, right here, Israel decides that they no longer want to be led by Jehovah directly. They want to be led by a king, just like all the other nations around them. So they demand a king. Saul is chosen. He's anointed king. And then for about 2 years, he is establishing himself in the kingdom. He fights off an attack against Jabesh-Gilead, and they gather at Gilgal. They renew the kingdom. And then right about here where this big red line is when the Philistines gather at Michmash and attack with a major army. Jonathan killed off the garrison of the Philistines, and the Philistines responded with a massive invasion, trying to bring Israel back into subjection again. All of that, which was chapter 13 and all of 14 that we've been going over for the last few weeks, takes place between these two red lines right there. It's just a couple of years that Saul has been crowned king, and he's been fighting the Philistines. In fact, the Battle of Michmash really takes place over just a few weeks or a few months. So we've got a lot of events crammed into that little bit of time. Okay, what we've just read tonight, verses 47 to 52, summarize from here all the way up to here. So you've got about a 20-year time span that's being summarized from the time Saul became king all the way up until just before... I don't know if you can see that little arrow there. That's another major battle that's going to take place, except Saul's not going to want to go out and fight that one, because in order to fight that battle, he'd have to fight a very tall, very strong-looking man named Goliath. And Saul doesn't want to. So he sits back with his army. All right. So, everything we've just read, when Saul had taken kingship over Israel, he fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab, against the Ammonites, against Edom, against the kings of Zobah, and against the Philistines. Wherever he turned, he routed them, and he did valiantly, and struck the Amalekites, and delivered Israel out of the hands of those who plundered them. That's what Saul's doing for 20 years. Okay? You've got to remember, he is the first king. There's a lot of work to do to establish Israel as an independent nation, because for the last 40 years, they've been under the dominion of the Philistines. And for times before that, they've been under partially the hand of other oppressors. And so for the last 350 years, ever since the entry into Canaan, Israel has gone back and forth from being strong and independent to being subservient to another nation. And it always coincided with how well they were obeying God. When they obeyed God, they became independent. They became their own national entity. When they disobeyed him and went into idolatry, God sold them into the hand of their enemies, and they became subservient to another nation. All right. Saul is the one that's going to begin to change that. Despite his failures, despite his disobediences, God is using Saul to accomplish God's program. And how often does God do that? He uses sinful people to accomplish his purposes and his ends. Because what is God's purpose for Israel? He's going to bring them to the point where he can put David on the throne and give Israel a picture of what the kingdom is going to be like. Because David is the key Old Testament picture, the Old Testament type of the Lord Jesus. David's kingdom represents in part what Jesus' kingdom is going to be completely. David's kingship over Israel represents in part what Jesus' kingship over Israel will be totally and fully. God's purpose is to bring Israel to the point where David can take the throne and make the kingdom of Israel all that it needs to be to accomplish the purposes of that type. That make sense? Okay. So, Saul is being used as the instrument of God to bring Israel to that point, because God is in absolute control. His purposes and plans are not dependent on our obedience. He wants us to obey. We're called to obey. But when we disobey, it doesn't throw his plan off one bit. Isn't that amazing? Somehow, our God is able to use all of our failures and all of our disobediences to still accomplish his ends. When Adam took that fruit off the tree, did that throw off God's plan? Not in the slightest. Because we're told, in, even in the New Testament, that God's purpose from before creation, before he ever spoke the world into being, his purpose was to put his son on that cross. His purpose was to establish his son as the ruler of everything. And Adam's disobedience worked into that plan. God has accounted for all of our rebellion in his plan. That's the sovereignty of God. It takes into account all of our sin. It takes into account all of our disobediences. We cannot throw off God's plan. Or, as I heard one pastor put it, God doesn't have a plan B. We have to all the time because we don't know everything. We have to have contingencies. Well, what if this happens? God doesn't have any contingencies. His plan is going to be accomplished, whether Saul obeys or doesn't obey. And that's what's going on here. God is using Saul to accomplish his purposes for his people, Israel. So there's the timeline. You can see we are roughly right around the year 1100. So if you're thinking to yourself, how long ago did King Saul rule over Israel? He began just about 1100 BC. The exact time is right around 1095. But if you can remember 1100, that'll get you real close. When was the Exodus from Egypt? Go back about 350 years. Israel left Egypt in 1495. Okay, was the Exodus. They spent 40 years wandering around the wilderness, and then they came into Israel in about 1455 or so. Okay, so they have been in the land for 350 years before Saul becomes king. And Saul is going to be king for 40 years from this point here all the way up. Well, I can't go off the screen that far. When Saul becomes king, okay, he spends the next 7 or 8 years here, and well, about 9 years later, here's an important event that really doesn't get much attention just yet, but there's a little boy born in Bethlehem whose name is David. And he's going to spend the first 18 years of his life or so doing something seemingly inconsequential. He's herding his father's sheep. Wait, you don't herd sheep, you shepherd sheep. Shepherd them. I heard a story one time of a man who went to Israel, and he was a pastor, and he was going through the tour and just enjoying the sights all throughout the land. And the tour guide saw a flock of sheep coming in and off the side of the road, and he started talking about how, well, here in Israel, we, our shepherds, lead the sheep. They don't drive them. They go in front of the sheep, and the sheep follow him. And what a perfect picture that is as believers. Jesus doesn't drive us from behind. He leads us, and we follow him. And just as he said that, the pastor looked out the window and said, well, wait a minute. That man is driving the sheep. He was behind him making noise, trying to get the sheep to go that way, and he was driving the sheep forward. And the tour guide looked around, looked at the man for a moment who was driving the sheep, and then looked back at his tour bus passengers and said, oh, that's not a shepherd, that's the butcher. The butcher doesn't care about the welfare of the sheep. Not too much, anyway. He cares about the welfare of his patrons and whether or not they like sheep. God leads us. Here's what Saul's been doing. So here's our map of Israel. And I've tried to label this for you, because there's some names mentioned here that might not be all that familiar to us. And in fact, they weren't very familiar to me, so I had to spend some time looking all these things up and trying to find some biblical data on who these people are. Back up those 400 years, okay? We talked about this just a little bit this morning in Sunday school as we're going through the book of Numbers. The people of Israel came up to the southern portion of Israel, right around in here, to a place called Kadesh Barnea, after the Exodus. It's only a year or so after the Exodus. And when they were at Kadesh Barnea, they sent out 12 men who traveled all up and down the land here and spied on the inhabitants and mapped out the land and brought back some of the produce. And they brought back a report to the people of Israel, and they said, ooh, yeah, this is a good land. Or two of them did, anyway. Well, no, they all said it was good land. But then what did they say? 10 of the men said, yeah, it's a great land, but, there's a problem. It's full of giants. It's a land that eats up its inhabitants. So yeah, it's a good land, but we're dead meat if we go in there. And 2 men said, no, it doesn't matter if we're small and they're big. It doesn't matter if we look like grasshoppers to them, because we have God on our side. And if he's pleased with us, he'll give us the land. So Joshua and Caleb said, let's go. But those other 10 convinced the entire nation to say, no, we're not going in. And God brought judgment on them, and for 40 years they had to wander around in the wilderness. After those 40 years, yeah, we read those verses this morning, and they're pretty brutal, the judgment that God brings on them and says, you're going to wander around the wilderness for 40 years until your bodies lie in the desert, until your carcasses lay in the desert. So you are going to die as a judgment of your disobedience here. So for 40 years, Israel turned back south, and they wandered all over the southern portion, south of where you see Amalek on there, and south of where you see Edom on there. And after the 40 years, they wanted to come up to this region, because God was going to have them cross into Israel this way. So they came up close to the land of Edom, and they asked Edom, let us pass through your land so that we can approach Israel right over here by the Dead Sea. Is it there? No, there it is. This is where they wanted to approach. Okay, they wanted to come up the eastern side of the Dead Sea and park right here and cross over to take Jericho. Edom said, no, you can't cross my land. And Edom responded with force. They marched their entire army out to block Israel. And God told Israel, you can't attack the Edomites. Now, who are the Edomites? Esau's descendants, right? Okay. They are Israel's brother, just about. Very close relatives, the Edomites. Well, they settled in all this land south of here. Petra, have you ever heard of Petra? Okay, city carved into the mountainside, that was in Edom. All right. They're very tough people, Edom. But God told the Israelites, when you go into the land, you will not dispossess Edom. You can't have it. That's theirs. I've given that to the sons of Esau as an inheritance. So they marched around the eastern side of Edom and came up this way. And they approached Moab. And they said, hey, Moab, can we go past you? We want to come over here. And Moab said, no. And Moab responded with force. But God said to Israel, you will not attack Moab. Because who are the Moabites? Children of Moab, Kim says. You're right. So who was Moab the children of? Oh, fella by the name of Lot fled from the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah to a town called Zoar. And he didn't stay in Zoar very long because the people there didn't like him. And he fled into the caves with just him and his 2 daughters. And his 2 daughters became very worried that they would never be able to marry and bear children for their dad. So they got their dad drunk. And in successive nights, they lay with him, and each were impregnated by their father. The one gave birth to a son named Moab. The other gave birth to a son named Ben-Ami, I think, if I remember right. They became the people of Moab and Ammon. And God told Israel, you will not dispossess either of these 2 nations, because I have given them that land that they're in as a possession to the sons of Lot. And even though they were born of an incestuous relationship, God said, I'm going to bless them and I'm going to plant them right where they are. He had purposes for those people. So, the northern border of Moab, listed in the scriptures, is this river here called the River Arnon. So the people of Israel were not allowed to cross into Moab. So they journeyed up here to the east side of Moab, and when they hit the Arnon, they circled around it and came in here between Moab and Ammon. Remember, they're not allowed to attack Moab. They're not allowed to attack Ammon. And they came over here, and they entered the land of a people called the Amorites. The Amorites came out and attacked them. Israel defeated the Amorites and took possession of all this land, from the river Arnon down here up northward to the river Jabbok. That's the northern border of the Amorites. Okay, they also conquered a good deal of the land up here, which was occupied by some of the Amorites. And this area becomes known as the land of Gilead. Okay? So when you talk about Gilead, they're talking about this region over here. Several of the tribes of Israel said, hey, this is good land. Let's settle here. So the Lord said, that's great. Settle there. So they did. And so this became Israelite possession. Saul, when he becomes king, is over here from this area of Benjamin, which is right in here. Jerusalem is right about there. And just north of it is a little strip of land that belongs to Benjamin. Over here, along the coastal plain area, is the area that's occupied by Philistines. The Philistines actually are of Greek descent. They're called the people of the sea. They came over and they inhabited that area about 300 or 400 years before the Exodus, and they've been settled in there for quite a long time. But these are the Philistines. I think maybe I've mentioned this to you today, but do you know why in the early 1900s, when Britain was getting ready to give up the land, the Holy Land, give up control of it, they were debating on what to call the place, whether to call it the Holy Land, or it wasn't Israel because there weren't many Jews living there. So they decided to call it by its Old Testament name, Palestine, which in Hebrew there originally were no vowels, and so all you had were the consonants. And if you take the consonants of Palestine and Philistine, they are the same consonants. Palestine is a modern way of saying Philistine. Right? So they called it the Palestine, they called it Philistine, after the Philistines that lived there. Down here to the south were the tribe of people called the Amalekites. Israel's going to have some problems with them a little bit later. They had some problems when they were at Kadesh Barnea before they entered their wilderness wanderings. But this is the situation that Saul encounters. He's king over this area, but he's having problems. The Amorites are not there. They don't exist when, or at least not as powerful as they were when Saul's king. Israel's going to have constant problems with Moab. She's going to have constant problems out of Edom. She's going to have a lot of problems from the Ammonites. And she's going to have lots of problems from this group called Zobah. Lots of problems out of these people, the Philistines, and some problems from the Amalekites. Saul's job over the next 20 years was to expand Israel's power base, to expand their territory, and to secure their control over their own land that God had given them to inherit. So he had to fight against Moab, who kept coming up and attacking this area. If you go back to Judges, the book of Judges, there's a time, Jephthah, when he's judge. He needs to become a judge because Moab is invading this area of Gilead. And what they're saying is, hey, when you Israelites came over here and you possessed the land, you took our land away from us. And Jephthah has to answer and say, no, we didn't. You didn't let us cross your land, so we didn't. We took everything north of the Arnon. That's not your land. It never has been. And there's a battle, and Israel wins. Edom is constantly harassing the people in the southern part of Judah down here. The Amalekites keep coming up and raiding this southern portion of Israel. The Ammonites are constantly raiding over here. Zobah is actually a lot farther north than what this map shows you. This is the first time Zobah is mentioned in the scriptures. But Zobah is a kingdom of people up in the north that constantly was allied with the nation of Syria. which later is going to become a major problem for Israel. So you can see what Saul is doing here, attacking the Ammonites, attacking the Moabites, attacking the Edomites, attacking Zobah, attacking Amalek, attacking Philistia. He's trying to establish Israelite control over this land that is within the pen here. He's making sure that they securely control their borders. We won't make any political references to that tonight, will we? Okay. They had to control the borders to be able to make sure that he had control over Israel. So, he fights against Moab. He fights against the Ammonites. He fights against Edom. He fights against the kings of Zobah and against the Philistines. And wherever he turned, he routed them. God is giving Saul major victories, so that the power all of these nations had been exerting upon Israel for the past 300 years is beginning to break. And Israel is becoming a nation. They're becoming a kingdom. They're becoming a kingdom in control of themselves. He did valiantly and struck the Amalekites. Do you remember why that was a valiant thing? Because remember what the spies saw in the region of Amalek when they went through it? That's where they saw the giants. Okay? A lot of giant people. A lot of modern scholars have said, oh, this is why you can't trust the Bible, because it talks about giants. There's no such thing as giants. Well, we just got to understand, God built an awful lot of variability into the human genome. Okay? Our trouble is our forefathers were so clustered in Europe, okay, and in way up north in Asia there, that we all look a lot alike. But we don't realize just how variable the human genetic code is. So that what came from Adam can produce all of the so-called races that we see. And I know that we've studied Answers in Genesis material. How many of you heard the song One Race? Or is it One Blood? One Blood. Okay, great song. Because God didn't make many races. He made people. In fact, I just heard a couple of months ago, there was an article in the paper that talked about, it might have been a year or so ago I saw this, but two black people in England gave birth to a white baby. Naturally. You know. No help in the birthing process through technology. It just happened. So, well, that variability is there. Your genes can get mixed up. Kim and I both have brown eyes, but guess what? We have four blue-eyed children. Yeah. How's that happen? Well, obviously, Kim's carrying a recessive blue-eyed gene, and so am I. Yeah. And those happen, the deck just gets shuffled that way. So, people can be small people. People can be big people. That is built into the human genome. One of the troubles with the giants was that everybody was so afraid of them and how strong they were that they all ganged up on them and started wiping them out. Because they're a military threat. You don't want them around. So as we wipe out the giants, that gene gets eliminated from the gene pool. So now we don't see many of them again because that information's getting lost. Eldon, you're going to say something. Yeah. That's right. And his sons and, well, I mean, came from Noah and his daughters-in-law. Right? So you get a little bit of extra gene pool from them. But yeah, you're right. It was much more limited than it was before that. So as the giants are getting killed off because they're threats, then you start eliminating that information from the gene pool. But Amalek was a major, major threat to Israel, and they're going to continue to be. So Saul is delivering Israel out of the hands who plundered them. All of the last 350 years that Israel has been plundered by other nations, Saul is putting a stop to that because he's establishing Israel as a major power in the region. A little bit about Saul's family life in the next few verses. This is fairly typical of the lists of kings that we're going to run into throughout the books of Samuel and Kings. They're going to tell us about his sons and about his daughters and about his wife, or wives as the case may be. Now the sons of Saul were Jonathan, Ishvi, Malchishua, and the names of his two daughters were these. The name of the firstborn was Merab, and the name of the younger, Michal. Jonathan we've met. He's the one that instigated the battle with the Philistines at Michmash. because he is a brave man. He's a daring man. He's a faithful man. And that's going to come out later in the narrative as well. Jonathan, we've met. Probably Jonathan is the firstborn. We don't think about this much, but if we go right here, we're not positive how old Jonathan is. But here at the beginning of Saul's reign, Jonathan is leading part of Saul's army. So Jonathan has to be at least 20 years old to be in the army of Israel. We have another 9 years or 10 years until David's born. One of the major themes throughout David's life is his close friendship with Jonathan. But it turns out, we don't think about this much, but Jonathan's got to be at least 30 years older than David. Yeah. So there's a little bit of timeline for you. So, Jonathan we've heard of. Ishvi is another one. Ish is the Hebrew word for a man. Interestingly, there are two other lists of Saul's descendants in the books of 2 Chronicles. Okay, or 1 Chronicles. You know those first 10 chapters that are the fun genealogies to read? Saul's family is listed there, and he has 4 sons listed in 1 Chronicles. And he also has, at the end of 1 Samuel, when Saul dies, it mentions 3 sons. It mentions Jonathan, Malchishua, who's mentioned here, and another son called Abinadab. Those 3 sons die in the battle with the Philistines at the end of the book of 1 Samuel. Ishvi is a name that isn't mentioned in 1 Chronicles. He doesn't die in the battle, but in 1 Chronicles there's a son named Ishbael, which is extremely close when it comes to Hebrew lettering. Ishbael is listed as one of Saul's sons. Here's an interesting little tidbit for you. Ishbael means a man of Baal. Who was Baal? He was the god of the Sidonians, and he was one of the gods of the Canaanites. Okay. So why does Saul name one of his sons a man of Baal? Another name that is mentioned in 2 Samuel, after Saul dies, David becomes king over the tribe of Judah. But the rest of the tribes don't want to take David as king yet, so they take Saul's son Ish-bosheth, and they make him king. So what probably is going on here is that Ishvi, Ishbael, and Ish-bosheth are 3 different names for the same boy. They all start with that name, Ish, man of. They're just listed differently in the genealogies. And that's not unusual. If you remember when we were going through the study of Matthew's genealogy, very often the names are listed somewhat differently. Okay. How many of you have a nickname? Yeah. Jim, what's your nickname? All right. Okay. A couple of our kids have nicknames. Hannah, what's your name? Twinkle. When she was little, I started calling her Twinkle, so now I call her my little twink. And Abby. Can I mention yours? Yeah. Pookie. She's my little Pook. So, probably in the genealogical records, your name's not going to go down as Pookie, though. Okay? I'll call you Abby. Or Abigail. Or Abigail. I think for a couple of years, Abby really thought her name was Abby Gail Faith, because we just called her that all the time. So Saul's sons are 3 of them listed here, probably because the one son that's not mentioned, Abinadab, hasn't been born yet. Okay, remember, we've got 20 years of history intervening. So Ish-bosheth is 40 years old when he takes the rule over the northern kingdoms. Saul reigned for 40 years. So Ish-bosheth was born right back here at 1095. All right, and then Saul ruled for 40 years, and then his son Ish-bosheth took over the northern kingdom. So these are the sons of Saul. The names of his 2 daughters were Merab and Michal. Actually, in the Hebrew, that sounds a lot like a boy's name to us, Michal, but in the Hebrew, you have to get your throat into Hebrew quite a bit, so the actual pronunciation is Michal. Okay? So you almost have to, don't spit on your neighbor's head in front of you, okay? Michal. And this gal is going to become important because she's going to marry another king, and his name is David. So this is Saul's family. His wife's name was Ahinoam, the daughter of Ahimaaz, and the name of the commander of his army was Abner, the son of Ner. They didn't worry too much about nepotism back then. So Saul's uncle becomes commander of the army, and he's very apt. He's very good at it, and he's going to stay in that position for quite a while. Kish was the father of Saul. Ner, the father of Abner, was the son of Abiel, which would be Kish's brother. Verse 52 is going to summarize these 20 years or so of history between Saul's coronation and this fight right here against the Philistines where David kills Goliath. There was hard fighting against the Philistines all the days of Saul. You want to know the legacy that Saul leaves us? He is a man of war. He's a man who fought constant battles. And again, as we go throughout his life, we see there are times when he is absolutely on. He's spot on and does what's right. And there are times when he is absolutely dead wrong. He's back and forth. And yet, God uses him in mighty ways. He is a man of war that's going to accomplish the delivering of the nation from foreign oppressors. Because that was his task as king, he establishes his power mostly militarily, because the last part of the verse says, when Saul saw, why is that so hard to say quickly? Saul saw any strong man or any valiant man, he attached him to himself. So every time they would go out to battle, remember, Israel is still mostly made up of a Minuteman army. They were called out at a moment's notice, and everybody in the nation, every able-bodied man between the age of 20 and 50, was supposed to come out to the army, bring whatever weapons you had, even if it was a pitchfork or a stick, and come to the army. And that was their army. But as they go into these battles, if Saul would see a young man who was able-bodied and who was good at battle, he would conscript him. He would bring him into the standing army, and he would make him part of the Israelite garrison. And Saul's going to start placing garrisons around the country to protect Israel from her foreign enemies. So this is Saul's legacy. Again, going back to our map here, Saul is faced with all of these nations around Israel, and his job largely is tied up in defending Israel's borders from foreign attackers. And this passage of Scripture shows us that at least in that area, he does it well. He defended Israel just like the king was supposed to. Now, we're going to get in next week to chapter 15. Is going to be his ultimate downfall with Amalek.